He is the moderating today's discussion. Scott was the longtime New York bureau chief and senior correspondent for Public Television's Nightly Business Report. He covered the financial markets, business, and the economy for the first and longest-running daily program dedicated to financial news on broadcast television. Scott now writes for various online sites to teach about the next generation of journalists and to advise companies and nonprofits on media relations, communication strategy, ethics, newsroom operations, and online application design and practice. He also writes an instructional blog, Financial Market Reporting, for the Donald W. Reynolds National Center for Business Journalism, and he also writes a personal blog on journalism, business, and economics called Public Offerings. Joining us on the panel is Tom Tully. He has been involved in the IPO market since the mid-1990s when he co-founded WebIPO, a place where investors could get research and access to deals during the dot-com boom. He's the author of High Profit IPO Strategies, Finding Breakout IPOs for Investors and Traders, which is now in its third edition. Tom has also been a longtime contributor to Forbes.com and InvestorPlace.com. Along the way, he launched other companies, including Hypermart.net and ExamWeb. We're also happy to have Jack Willoughby today. Jack is a senior editor at Barron's who wrote about the financial publication's offerings in the offerings column during the most active years of the new issue market. He covered business news for 40 years and was the Knight Bagdot Fellow in Economics and Business Journalism at Columbia University. Jack is a native of Canada who previously worked for the Globe and Mail, Forbes, and Institutional Investor. And John Devine is here. John is an investing reporter at U.S. News and World Report, where he covers financial markets and the economy with a focus on individual stock analysis. He previously wrote about the stock market for The Motley Fool and Investor Place. His work has appeared on Yahoo Finance, MSN Money, and AOL Daily Finance. Now, before we jump in, a couple quick points of business for our listeners. If you have a question for our panel, we'd love to get those. Please email them to sabew@sabew.org. That's S-A-B-E-W at sabew.org. Those questions will be forwarded to Scott. He'll present them to the panel. Once again, questions go to sabew@sabew.org. With that, I will hand things over to Scott and the panel. Scott, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Patrick. We are going to begin really by going quickly around to the members of our panel to make a little bit of an opening presentation. I have to making the assumption that our audience really kind of covers the gamut in terms of how much experience you have in covering financial markets in general and IPOs in particular. So we'll forgive us a little bit if we go back and try to kind of set the scene. We people who have experience in television and we're always limited to 2.5 quick minutes are always accused of being experts at putting a superficial gloss over things. So I guess I will start out by doing just that and let some of my fellow panelists get involved in some of the more detailed specifics. The IPO is something that usually represents a significant coming of age for a company. How you finance a company when you're an entrepreneur and you have a great idea has changed a lot over the years. It usually starts out with you raiding your own piggy bank and then possibly borrowing money from your friends and your family. Somewhere along the line, you might have gone down to the local bank and attempted to get some funding. Those days are pretty much over because there is very little chance that you'll have a local bank and a local banker you can call on, someone who probably knows you because you've been doing business with him, and someone certainly who knows the market, knows the community you're operating in. We find today that so many communities are served only by branches of very large conglomerates that it's very hard for the small business people and the startup to really get funding in that matter. I'm sure there are exceptions, but it's a story that I hear over and over again. The venture capital firms are the places, and the hedge funds are places where people who have a lot of money and are willing to take considerable risks by funding startup companies, they are a source for funding. The different ones look for funding in different areas. They are the kinds of people you wind up wooing, whining and dining, and it's hard to predict exactly what is going to cause any particular venture capital firm to decide that they're going to want to put money in your venture. At that point, you may be for the first time actually issuing shares in your company. These are usually private placements rather than the initial public offerings that we're focusing on today. And the private placements differ in that they're going to people who the government in its own laws and regulations will classify as investors who are capable of taking on high risk. They have lots of money. They're sophisticated enough to do their own due diligence, supposedly, and they're prepared to lose their entire investment. One of the big coming-of-age motion, times for the company, though, is when it does an initial public offering. This means it goes ahead and issues stock, which can be traded on a public exchange, and it has to meet a wide range of regulatory requirements. Some of them are in the securities law. Some of them are simply accounting standards, which are also very rigid and which must be adhered to. And actually, because in the United States anyway, we have what are known as self-regulating exchanges, the most stringent rules are actually the rules that are promulgated by the exchanges themselves. That's why, for example, back in the days when things were a lot less complicated and you had the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ, or the over-the-counter electronic exchange, you could pretty well look at a company and figure out which exchange would be appropriate for it. The New York Stock Exchange had the toughest rules in terms of regulations and financing and disclosures, and the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ, would have the least. And so you had a lot of startups, a lot of tech companies starting on the NASDAQ, and you had the old traditional line companies, the blue chips, with the large capitalizations sitting around on the New York Stock Exchange. A lot of these rules of thumb are gone in the modern age, among other things. So much trading is now done electronically. A place like the New York Stock Exchange has electronic off of the exchange floor facilities, and the regulations are nowhere near as tight as they used to be. So what does it mean to go public? It means basically that you have to file public information about what's going on in your company, and you start out with a prospectus. Studying the prospectus is probably one of the first things that a reporter is going to want to do when they come to cover the initial public offering of shares for a particular company. I'm sure some of my panel partners will go into some detail into how that's done. I will do this quickly by just saying that the initial offering kind of documents often come out with all sorts of warnings printed in red ink, so much that they got to be known as red herrings, all over them, which basically say this is a highly risky venture, watch out. It is very rare to have an established company, one everybody's heard of, and one that's been doing business for a long time, do an initial public offering. There are, however, exceptions every year, and I think we're going to, as again, some of the other panelists are going to discuss some of the recent ones, some of the big name ones. But mostly these are companies that are just being introduced to a general public. And so you will have to study the IPO documents, the prospectus in particular, very carefully. Is the company making money? Is it losing money? Does it have a game plan, usually over maybe 5 years, for achieving profitability? And as I've always said to people, probably the most interesting part of reading a prospectus from my standpoint has always been the footnotes, because if there were ever any things that they really wanted to bury and hide, they were always hidden down in the footnotes. I kind of had the same reaction when reading a quarterly report. I always want to see the kind of stuff that's buried at the bottom of the page or in the back. I'd like to turn the discussion over now to the panelists, because each one of them offers a different perspective based on some of their experience. And why don't we start with John Devine, who is, as you've already heard, an investing reporter at U.S. News and World Report, where he's been covering the financial markets and the economy, with a particular focus on the stock analysis of individual stocks. John,
all right, great. Well, thank you, Scott, and thank you, Cebu, for having me. I sort of wanted to start on a point of more of a narrative point for the journalists and talk a little bit about Snapchat's recent decision to issue non-voting shares in their big IPO in March. And I thought that was a very, it was an unprecedented move. And I thought it was sort of indicative of a troubling trend that we're seeing with IPOs and just in the market in general, and that is dual class share structures that give a lot of power to insiders and sort of the top bigwigs in management, but don't give much of a say to the retail investor and the public investor who really many of us write for. And so just taking that perspective and looking in the S1 and seeing, are there different classes of stock? How much power is concentrated in how few hands? And sort of keeping that in mind can be really important because it seems that a lot of companies nowadays are really just want to tap the public markets for their money, but they don't want to also they don't want a quid pro quo of giving them any really real say in the business. And I'm an old-fashioned guy who likes to think of companies in the way that Buffett often does, which is buying a share of a company is like buying a slice of a business. It's like owning a business, and that's the way I like to think of it. I think it's a proper way to think of it, and it doesn't really seem like this trend is taking that same perspective. So it worries me a little bit, and I think it's something to keep an eye on. And there are reasons for dual class share structures. There's legitimate reasons. Media companies often want to do this to retain some level of independence and stability and trustworthiness. The New York Times, Viacom, Comcast, CBS, News Corp, a lot of these companies have dual class share structures and have for years. And, I think there's a legitimate case to be made for that. The other case that we're seeing more and more of is founder-led companies like Snapchat and Facebook and Google and companies like that, where the founders really want to retain control. And I think that in some cases it's certainly worked out for shareholders, but we have to be careful and see if there's a legitimate justification for that, or whether they're just going to sort of function like a private company while taking public money and make all the decisions that they want to and sort of be tyrannical with their structure. So anyways, I know it's sort of rambling for a little bit over here, but that was what I wanted to talk about for my opening. So thanks again for having me, and I'll turn it over to the next person.
This is Scott again. That's actually a very good point, John. I remember that the New York Stock Exchange for many, many years had a longstanding rule that basically said there will not be dual-class stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange. There were, however, always some exceptions, as you've pointed out, grandfathered in, and the New York Times is certainly one of them, and Dow Jones, again, as you pointed out, was another. When you discuss the media companies, that seems to be a trend that has continued. I remember reading the Google prospectus when it came out, and there was a paragraph. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but I got to tell you, my my language is pretty much, it's got to be very close to what it literally said. If you think you're going to have any control, you know, and vote in a say in how this company's managed, or even get a great deal of information about what it is we're doing going forward, forget about it. This isn't the company for you. Needless to say, when it came out and it popped and went to about 80, I looked at it and said, "My God, that's pretty rich. That's not a good investment." It goes to show you why I continued working for public television instead of retiring as a very rich person, because my stock calling expertise was so good. Tom, let's turn to you. I know that you founded WebIPO, or co-founded WebIPO, which was a source that I used for getting IPO information during the years. And you also, because you were an entrepreneur and a founder of the company, you certainly have something to say about, you know, what it takes to get a company going and to raise the capital to get it going, as well as being the writer of a book that I think everybody would be interested in. So let me turn the floor over to you for a bit.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks very much. And, so I've been studying, they're called S1s or prospectuses, for over 20 years. And at WebIPO, what I would do is download the prospectus from the Edgar website and just try to figure it out. There were no books in IPOs when I started. I just had to learn on my own and figure it out. And what I realized is that they all look the same. They all had the same structure. And the structure you see 20 years ago is the same structure you see today, because we have these laws, SEC laws, that were created in the 1930s, back before there was even the Internet. So that tells you about how laws change. They don't change a lot. Especially when it comes to regulating and when it comes to people's money. So when you take a look at the prospectus, the good news, you know, it looks imposing and overwhelming, but the good news is that it's all the same structure. It's like an outline, and you can go to the places you need to go fairly quickly to get the information you need. But there's another resource you can use to supplement the S1 and maybe make more of an understanding of what you're reading, retailroadshow.com. They actually record there the initial roadshow for management. It's usually 20 minutes to half an hour, and you'll get a really good understanding of the company, of the business model, the products, the management. You know, I remember looking at the Tesla S1, and Elon Musk was, I mean, if you know, after that prospectus, if you didn't buy a Tesla, you'd have to get your brain examined, because he was such a good money raiser. So you could see in action these people, how they react and their vision in video instead of the printed word. But given it, going back to the prospectus, the things I do look at is, you know, I go to the first couple pages and I read the background of the company. I want to get a sense of who they are, what their business model is, and I want to see the market information. You know, what are the secular drivers to this market? You know, mobile's big, you know, okay, or maybe China with Alibaba, or, you know, social media or online video. I want to get a sense of, you know, where these markets are going and what are the drivers, and how does this company play in that market? How important is that service or product in that market, and how defensible is that product? I also want to see, is this company taking steps to innovate the product and make it better and better? And also, is it resonating in foreign markets? Because you want, you know, to be a sustainable public company, you need to be big. You need to have big markets and a lot of runway ahead of you. So I want to see leverage in the product. I want to see leverage into overseas markets. I want to also see some path to profitability. It doesn't have to be profitable, but at least it's going in the right direction. Then the other section I look at is risk factors. You can just click and go to risk factors. Some of the red flags, one is going concern from the auditor. If the auditor says that, that means that the company may run out of money. So obviously that's not a good thing. I also want to look at, will this company need more financing? I know back in the day we saw these mobile infrastructure companies go public, and they went bankrupt because they kept having to go back to raise money. This is the same thing with biotech companies. They always have to go out and raise money. And then the other two things I look at that need to be disclosed in the S1 and the risk factors are the product or the customer concentration. How much of your revenues are represented by a few number of customers? And we've seen that with Twilio went public. The stock has crashed since then because Uber is starting to go away from Twilio, and also there's some concern that maybe Facebook's WhatsApp might do the other thing, might do that as well. And also product concentration is another thing. And Snap, you know, we brought up Snapchat here. You know, that's a company with one app. You know, that app doesn't do well. This company doesn't do well. It's not like Facebook that has all these different apps that they can rely on. So I'm always concerned, especially when it comes to dealing with something that could be a fad or very fickle, that gets me concerned. So those are the things that I look at in the S1, and it's just practice makes perfect. It just takes time, and over time it gets easier and easier.
Thank you, Tom. Let me ask you a question right away. We have a question from Margot Roosevelt of the Orange County Register. If you would spell out the name of the Roadshow website that you were talking about.
Sure.
If you spell it out a little slower so everybody could get it.
Yeah, sure. Retail, R-E-T-A-I-L, Roadshow, roadshow.com. And you don't have to sign up. You don't have to register. Most companies have their roadshows on there. Some don't. But, Snap, Tesla, the big ones. I think even Alibaba had it on there. So it's a great place for information. That brings the information alive as opposed to reading it on a, you know. And also keep in mind, these prospectuses are written by attorneys, so that's why they're poorly, very boringly written.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about it, I also, amongst all the other crazy things that I've done in life, I've been programming computers for many years, many, 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 many years, you know, since they were very large things and they filled gymnasiums. And all of these reports, even the S1s, but also even more importantly, the quarterly reports, the K1s and everything, are now on the Edgar, the SEC's website, as well as other places, in a machine-readable format. And if you're getting into some of the, data journalism, data analytics, data analysis kind of things that we're doing in so many newsrooms today, there are ways to write programs that take a look at this stuff and can get down and at least compare some of the standard boilerplate that Tom talked about, the ratios and things like that, and can do it, you know, programmatically and graphically, and
well,
makes for very efficient.
Well, you don't even have to be a data analyst to do this. So you can take that and put it into a Word doc.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually do a compare from one Word doc to the other. But what I've done is, you know, stuff like, maybe mobile, the word mobile. How many times is that used in this prospectus? You know, and you'll find that there's certain concepts or themes that are run through the prospectus that might provide some information to you as the reporter. You know, if you're not seeing certain things, you know, maybe that's not where management is, you know, thinking right now. Maybe they should be thinking. You know, the interesting thing about the Facebook S1, you put mobile on there and you would have gotten crickets in the S1. And that became a huge problem for them. And eventually they figured that out. But I think that's another interesting, you don't have to be, some super analytical person with machine predictive analytics to do this on your own. You can do some simple analytics.
Also, by the way, take a look in the fine print and see if anybody's suing them for anything, because I always find their little nuggets that you wind up discovering just by looking at kind of pending litigation, particularly like intellectual property and things like that may give a hint that this great invention or process that they're trying to market may not exactly hold up in the long term. Jack, let's bring you in. Jack Willoughby is a senior editor at Barron's, and Barron's, of course, is the marvelous weekly publication that really gets, I think, its thumb on the markets and on the economy and the financial world in general. And Jack authored for a long period of time The Offerings and the Offerings, the wonderful column they had on the new issue market. Jack, it's all yours.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Cebu, for inviting me, and thank you, Scott, for the kind introduction. I mean, I feel like a dinosaur in this situation. I mean, the IPO, I hear people talk about the IPO market the way it is today compared to what it was. I mean, it's totally different today, and I'll just lay out some of my opinions and just to get it. I think the things have changed so radically that back in the early 90s, when the IPO market was used to raise capital, there was this idea that this notion that all companies should be public, that basically, and in exchange for going public, you would have to provide this information. And what we're seeing now is the IPO market is becoming largely highly professionalized, and the retail investor is less and less a factor in that. Again, in my opinion, largely because while the regulators deregulated the tougher provisions, as John talked about the double voting share, the standards basically were reduced in order to encourage more public companies, to make it easier to go public. But essentially what they did with the Facebook offering and with a couple of other key offerings have made it easier to stay private. With the Facebook IPO, they basically changed it. Congress changed the rules to allow you to stay private if you have up to 2,000 shareholders of record, whereas up until the Facebook IPO, it was impossible. A lot of these unicorns would be forced by law to basically come public, because the theory in the U.S. law was that you should be public if you were tapping the American capital markets. Now, that bargain has changed, and it's been chipped away through various means, and now you've got, by and large, the capital basically being raised through private markets. So if you're talking to new reporters looking at it, I think you should make yourself aware of the private market as well, the D notices, the private equity things. There's two key rules that you got to keep in mind. One is this, the limit on the number of shareholders of record. Then there was another one where they restricted the number of shareholders of private funds to 100 shareholders. Once that was turned over, that allowed private equity to come in. And what's happened is private equity has flooded in so that the private market dwarfs the public market. And essentially, they're taking public, a lot of listings off the market, taking them private. Now, why would that matter? Well, because in the public market, you have to have audited statements. In the private market, you don't even have to have audited statements. Uber doesn't have to file any financial reports. Now, it does because, you know, by agreement with the people that provided capital, but that's not the way the capital markets in the United States have worked up to now. So I'm just sort of raising a couple of points, but I'm a great plotter, and I believe, as boring as that stuff is, you would be amazed at the things when you read these S1s. Just read each word, and you'll see stuff like, and the thing that I like to look at the most is to get a sense of where is the money going that's coming public. It's very, you know, they'll have an IPO where 50, 60% of the proceeds will go to the selling shareholders. So you have to read very carefully that first four or five pages to determine whether the money's actually even going to the company, okay, or whether it's not somebody selling out. Anyway, that's sort of my introductory comment.
That's really an excellent point, Jack. I'm you're right. I'm kicking myself here that none of us thought to raise that. Is that, of course, I mean, one of the traditional reasons for doing the public offering is to help pay back the people who were the early investors. But as Jack pointed out, you can wind up with most of the proceeds of the public offering going to doing that rather than to growing the company. And he's absolutely right. You want to look for something like that. Jack, you mentioned the term denotice. Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, there's a theory, and you just touched on it, Scott, briefly. But to expand on your original point, there's this theory in securities law that these experts, these so-called experts, the people that with a lot of money to lose or are brilliant, just generally smart people, they become qualified investors or private investors or accredited investors, and they can raise money, they can tap the market as long as they file these D notices, which are that indicate the number of investors in a private investment. That's usually a public document. Those are good. But I've always thought, you know, to encourage reporters just to read. If you read the first 100 pages of the Alibaba prospectus, and you believe that that's a good investment, then I just wish you good luck. I mean, because it's just all about plotting and reading, and you know, I say that with Alibaba, you know, flying all over. But we live in a world where cream rises, but garbage floats now and for a while. And it's kind of tough to keep that in mind. I mean, you know.
Those are good points. Let me remind everybody for our listeners that we are looking forward to your questions, and you should be addressing them to sabew@sabew.org. And those will then get forwarded to me, and I can ask them of the panel. Also, is Lauren Hirsch online? Has she joined us by any chance? She was to be a member of our panel, and we don't know. We don't know if she checked in or not. Hello? No. All right. Well, then let us proceed where we were. I'd like to come back to John. We were talking about some of this. Delisting or never listing kind of things. I remember probably my best name-dropping story about this is Michael Dell, because I remember covering Michael Dell's IPO, and then, of course, the Dell Computer Company, you know, its fortunes waxed and waned over a period of time, and he wound up finally with venture help taking the company back private again, where it continues, you know, today. I suppose I could ask this of any member of the panel, but do you have other examples of this kind of thing? Do you see this taking the company back private to be a mounting, a growing trend?
Go ahead.
Well, I just think that it's just a proven fact that we have fewer listings now. The public market is shrinking. And the reason it's shrinking is they have all these private equity funds raising capital, because you got to understand, interest rates for a long period have been at zero, so there is no cost of capital. They've been funding this buyback, so the public market is of listings is shrinking.
How about the bond market? Is it easier because the interest rates are so low to raise money that way rather than obviously, when you issue shares, you at least are supposed to be giving up some control. When you go into the bond market, you're not doing that. Are we seeing more bond market trading?
I think we have in recent years. I remember a few years back, Verizon issued a big bond issue for. I can't remember exactly what acquisition it was, but yeah, I mean, that's, I think, an overlooked issue, really, for a lot of investors. And the market is just how these low rates for such an extended amount of time have been able to really finance a lot of the blue chip companies and their acquisitions, and there's been, you know, sort of a boom in some large M&A and, you know, just massive deals that we haven't seen before. And a lot of that is enabled by the bond market and extremely low rates. And it's logical. It makes sense. So, yeah, that's what I would say about that.
But just remember, Scott.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to butt in. But the thing that you got to keep in mind is that the law used to say that if you're gonna sell raise capital and you're going to tap the American public markets, you have to go public. In other words, there's a law that said if there's more than 500 shareholders, you filed an S-1 already, buddy, because that was the problem that Facebook went up against. And I'm sure you call that offering was very controversial, but Congress obliged Zuckerberg and basically said, okay, in the Jobs Act, we'll make you know, 200,000. Well, that then sort of goes back on this bias towards that's been in the law that says if you're going to raise capital in America, you got to be public. So anyways, it's sort of an interesting little side story to, you know.
It's interesting. Just as we're talking here, I've got some news on another screen, but I'll show you some of the things you want to look for in these S-1s, and you want to look at the vulnerabilities. Blue Apron, I'm trying to see when Blue Apron, which is this company that delivers meal kits, you know, to your home. They did an IPO. I'm trying to see when they did their IPO. It's not
June 28th. June 28th.
Right. I knew it wasn't very, very long ago. Anyway, Amazon has filed today a trademark on meal kits. And so obviously that there's a vulnerability when you have a company with a single product and really a single business strategy, their stock is just getting clobbered at the moment. Just simply because a giant like Amazon went ahead and maybe stepping on their trademark.
Scott, the kind of
things you got to look for.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I found very helpful to look for is in the modern offerings, it used to be the retail investor is really not much of a factor, okay? I mean, in my opinion, maybe 10-15%. But if you look at Blue Apron, for example, when it came public, look at the first 2 days of trading, okay? The first 2 days of trading very often will show you how this book build is being done. And Blue Apron, funny you should mention it, I did a calculation at roughly 1.7 times. See, they were offering about, I forget how many shares were they offering, 30 million shares. Well, you know, in the first 2 days trading, you got almost 60 million shares traded, which indicates the offer is, in my termination, spun. In other words, the shareholder base turns over almost completely, more than 100%. So it shows you what's happening is what they're doing is they're building, they're layering the big buyers have been sold out. So it's generally an indication if it turns over more than once that the syndicate's weak and there's a lot of selling. And I found that to be a helpful guide. The first 2 days trading.
Well, just to go off on that a little bit too, when the whole IPO process, you had this roadshow that goes on for a couple of weeks, they set the pricing and then they ultimately price the deal. The problem with Blue Apron was that they set the initial pricing, I think, at 15 to 17 a share, and then they priced it at 10, which means that this was a deal going down the drain very quickly.
They mistook the pricing, basically, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they priced it too high. The demand wasn't there. That spooked a lot of investors. The other thing, too, is while this IPO was in process, speaking of Amazon, Amazon agreed to acquire Whole Foods, which threw a whole other wrench into the works. So that was another big factor that usually when you see a pricing go down that much, there's something really bad going on. And I think a big part of that was the Amazon factor. Investors were just saying, you know, can a company like Blue Apron really survive?
And of course, an investment bank that hadn't done its homework.
Well, they need to get their fees. So,
Okay, let me remind everybody listening again that we are taking questions. Please address them to sabew@sabew.org. And we have one from Ms. Roosevelt of the South California News Group. She asks, isn't taking a public company private, a healthy way to get around the short-termism which has resulted in companies not investing in research and development or in hiring, but instead concentrating on boosting share prices.
That's a. Could I take that one, Scott?
Yes, please.
I think that's a great question, and it is. There have been managers have complained to me a lot about this, what we'll call short-termism. The problem is that if this happens too many times, the argument can be made that the company that's going private is free riding on the public information of the public companies that they're competing with. Am I making any sense here, or do you get my point?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I mean, go ahead, please.
Yeah. So this Tom, I think there is something to be said that we get, you know, we go on a quarterly basis, you know, you gotta produce every quarter. But then you see a company like Netflix, you know, that here's a company that was originally a DVD distributor and was able to transform its business into an online online premium content provider. And a lot of managements would have said, you know what, let's just take the company private because no investors would even go for that. I mean, you know, completely changing your business to one to the other, and yet it's a highly valuable company and it's performed great for shareholders. So I think that, I think a lot of times it's an excuse. You know, they're not, a lot of times management isn't performing. It doesn't know how to deal with the street and figure out what, you know, and doesn't really maybe even understand how to navigate and change and evolve. I think investors will give you the benefit of the doubt if you have a convincing plan. If not, good luck. So I think, you know, I do think there's some cases where it's legit, but I think don't underestimate management's ability to come up with lots of excuses for their own problems.
And I just want to piggyback on Tom there. Netflix did, when they were changing their business model, they did have that little snafu where I believe, did they try to spin off one of their DVD business?
Right.
Yeah.
And they had a whole pricing plan that was a complete disaster. And that kicked, you know, crushed the stock. And all of a sudden, you know, Icon came in, of all people, who's probably the most short-term person there is out there. And he made a bundle off of the company. You're going to probably take a hit. And I think for management, it's mostly about, let's just, you know, be honest and tell the street what's going on and what's happening in our industry. And here's our plan. And we think it's a good plan. And it's worked out. But
can I address Tom's point? I think I agree with most of what he's saying, but I also want to tell people there's the other side. If you look at the market now, you can just literally taste the fear on the part of investors of Amazon, and I think one of the big issues to continue answering that going private question that was originally posed, one of the big problems going on behind the scenes is that all American industries are getting concentrated. There's a thing called the Herpendahl Index. I couldn't even spell it. This is the German index that indicates the concentration of industries. That's been increasing over the last 10 years. And to the point where it's a concern, and you got to understand, any kind of regulation or antitrust is regarded, it's totally in disrepute today for whatever reasons. And the thing is that there are a lot of laws on the books that aren't even being enforced. I'll give you an example. There are things called the anti-tying rules that forbid a bank from providing credit and forcing a customer to take any other product as a condition of that loan. That's a criminal act. It exists in the statutes. And, you know, there's all kinds of tying going on today, but nobody wants to look at that. It's a kind of vulnerability that exists in the books that maybe not now, but maybe 10 years from now, and a good reporter should keep their eye on, is maybe there'll be some big antitrust actions, or there'll be a movement toward antitrust. Because everything shows that the industry, the industries that are where everything's going private are concentrating. And that's got to affect consumers at some point in terms of higher prices.
Well, we saw just recently, a couple weeks ago, Google got hit in Europe on an antitrust action. Qualcomm is being hit in Asia with antitrust. So, maybe we're lax here in the United States, but a lot of these companies, and a lot of these fast-growing companies like Uber and so on, have gone international a lot quicker than companies did, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So that might be a tripwire, not so much in the U.S., where we're not as forceful on these, but there are other countries that may see it as a national security issue. We don't want Google
right.
to be too powerful. We don't want Uber to, go to China. China doesn't want Uber. They want to kill Uber. And I think they effectively did that. So I think that's a big trend in the next 10, 20 years is the impact of the international markets on these companies. I think that and they'll find it. They'll pass a law. They'll do something to blunt that.
It's interesting. I think we've probably come up with subjects for two or three other other conferences that we ought to have here. I have had arguments, long discussions about antitrust issues so much that I'm not really going to start now, or that'll be the end of our hour.
I'm sorry, Scott.
No, I'm fascinated by this, and everything everybody has said is right on, and things that reporters have to be aware of because it's developing in front of us. Clearly, antitrust today means something different than it did 20, 30 years ago when I covered the bundling or the tying cases against Microsoft and IBM and companies like that. Clearly, the goal of antitrust laws in the United States is quite different than it is in many other countries, like Europe. In Europe, the antitrust regulators, or anti-competition, as they call it, regulators will look to protect companies. I've actually written a column back in those days when I was writing for PBS.org about the fact that it always seemed to be an American company that was hurting a European company, which I thought was kind of interesting. But the bottom line being, in the United States, we don't, traditionally our antitrust laws are simply whether or not we have some situation developing that's going to hurt consumers. If it's going to hurt other companies, that's their problem. The question is it going to hurt consumers? So when we talk about Amazon, for example, are we in a new world, or is Amazon just doing what Walmart and Costco did before that? And the neighborhood grocery store, I'm thinking particularly of the recent, the Whole Foods and the move into the food market, what the local grocery store did to the grocery store chain did to the ma and pa store before that, or do we have something new here that we have to be worried about? I don't know. It'd be a great topic to discuss. Maybe Sabu wants to think about that for something in the future. Let me go back just a little bit to the IPO bid and ask a little bit of inside baseball, but since we're all on the same baseball team here on this call, it's a fair question. Have we created or contributed, we being the news media, created in some way to the short-termism by playing the quarterly earnings statements as if they are some sort of sporting event? I mean, at the Nightly Business Report, we went through a year's worth of discussions and finally decided that we were going to eliminate language like Company X beat expectations by a penny. Because, as I pointed out after talking to, four gazillion CEOs, any CEO worth their salt can move the earnings a penny or two in any given quarter. I mean, you cook the books to the point where you do it consistently over a long period of time, you're probably doing something illegal. But clearly, in any given quarter, you just buy, you know, did you book the sale today or tomorrow? You know, are we going to, we got a bad quarter, we may as well dump the garbage that's been sitting around on the books anyway. I mean, that sort of thing goes on all the time. So I always said we want to talk about year-over-year reporting. We want to talk about trends. We don't want to make this a put up a scoreboard as to what the Wall Street consensus was and what the report came out, particularly when the difference is a percent or two. Do you think that that's part of the problem, or are we innocent?
No, I don't think we're innocent.
I was going to just say I think there's some truth to that, but there is the point that, you know, we are covering Wall Street and the gyrations of the stock market oftentimes. And, if there's a big movement in the stock because of a quarterly report, and that's the way that Wall Street is thinking about it, you know, there's some, utility in reporting, you know, just the sort of the logic behind that. But I agree largely with your point that, perhaps we are a little myopic sometimes, and it helps to zoom out. I just wanted to sort of pivot back really quickly to a few of the S1 issues I didn't get to bring up because I sort of rambled on about Snapchat for a little bit. I think that the Jobs Act, which is applicable to the Snapchat IPO, is probably going to become more and more relevant in the near future. It exempts companies from certain reporting and audit requirements, and as well as some revelations around executive compensation. So I think that's important to keep in mind, and just see if there's if the IPO that you're covering is going to take those exemptions, or if they even can, that are allowed through the Jobs Act. And then stock-based compensation expense, is that a big expense that these companies are having on their books, and does it create big discrepancies between GAAP and non-GAAP income? And then the length of the lockup period, which of course is the amount of time that executives are allowed to take before they can sell a large chunk of shares and insiders. But anyways, I know that's a lot to think about, but I just wanted to mention those before the call was over.
No, very good. Let me remind everybody, and in fact, that lockup thing, again, is an excellent point. How quickly are the founders going to cash out? Let me remind everybody once more, if they've got any questions, sabew@sabew.org. And if not, why don't we? I'm just going to take it in. I'll take it the backwards order from where we did our little openings, and see if anybody has any final thoughts. Jack.
I just think that that we just started broaching the topic. I mean, IPOs involve a lot more than just necessarily going public. But I think that we. Again, I wish we had another half hour, but I think that's pretty well all I got to say on it. And but just keep reading that S1, and there's another thing that's helpful. If you go to the SEC website, they'll have what they call a forms page, and you go on the forms page, any document that the SEC, the 10Q, the 10K, you can find the questionnaire that the SEC gives to the companies that they answer. So if you have any questions and you can't find sources or nobody wants to talk to you, I found those forms to be the best and truest sources you could ever get.
Very good. And Tom, besides everybody going out and getting a copy of Finding Breakout IPOs for Investors, now in its third edition, what is your big takeaway from today?
Yeah. Well, I think like everyone said, there's so many different issues involved. Retail roadshow to me is something that might be our first place to go. That'll give you a sense of the company, and then look at the prospectus. The prospectus makes a lot more sense. And as Jack mentioned, other things you can go even deeper if you have it. And I think the other thing is just, do you have the time to do all this? There's only so much time in the day. it can be tough. So, but I do think, you know, the retail roadshow, even just watching the first 10 minutes of it, usually the first part explains mostly the company, and the last part goes deep into the financials. So you could watch the first half of it and probably get a good sense of the company from retailroadshow.com. Then you actually even have to go through the whole thing. So, and you know, I think with going even beyond that, like I mentioned before, you know, there are these, you know, Jack mentioned the pricing action in the first couple of days. That's very important. The underwriters had the legal right to support the IPO, to put some supporting bids on the IPO. They don't do that forever. They may try it a little bit, and then once that's over, like I think we've seen with Blue Apron, you know, that's just a falling rock, and, you know, it could take a while for that to find some support. The other thing, too, maybe the last point about it is that, you know, we've had a whole rush of venture capital. All these unicorns, billions of dollars have been invested in these companies. They're going to have to go public. I mean, there's just, you know, Google can't buy every one of these companies. They're going to have to go public to start paying back these investors. So I do think, you know, maybe not this year, but over the next 5 or 10 years, these companies are going to start coming public. And there's going to be excitement. There's going to be duds like Blue Apron. So there'll be a lot to write about. I think that's really good news. There's a lot of pent-up supply ready to go. And, you know, in a venture capitalist, by their own venture funds, are supposed to get some liquidity after 10 years. And a lot of these companies have been around for that for longer than that period of time. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to go public in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, that sounds like a bullish outlook for those of us who write about IPOs, too.
Exactly. Yeah, so there'll be a lot to write about, I'm sure.
John, let me give you the last word.
All right, yeah. I think what everyone else has said is exactly right. There's so much to cover when it comes to this area, but yeah, a lot of these private companies that are big unicorns will have to go public soon. You know, Spotify, Uber obviously is going to be the mammoth one, although I think personally they probably missed their window of opportunity for the prime time to go public with all this horrible PR mess that they're in right now. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how some of these more recent IPO failures, if you will, like Blue Apron and Snap, I wouldn't, maybe not failures, but they've been certainly underperformers in the market. If that'll impact the IPO market going forward, and because, you know, those are getting a lot of press and obviously they haven't been very good. So I just wanted to close out with sort of where I began, which was the idea of, you know, one share, one vote. And, you know, I just think it is important to not sort of dilute the standards for retail investors and the expectations to, you know, if you buy a share, you should get one vote, and just like everybody else. And, you know, there is some talk about possibly excluding some of these companies that are issuing non-voting shares from major indices like the S&P indices and MSCI. So that could be interesting to see going forward. But that's all I have to say, so thanks again for having me.
Well, very good. I see our hour is up. It went by very quickly. I want to thank John, Tom, and Jack, and thank Patrick Sanders of the Cebu Training Committee, and Cebu for hosting us today. And if nobody else has anything else, then we will wish everybody a good day. Patrick, you there?
Let me put my sincere thank you out to you, Scott, and to the entire panel, Tom, Jack, and John. I think it's been a great discussion, so thanks very much.
To our listeners,
please mark your calendars for our next teletraining session, which is scheduled for 2 o'clock Eastern on Monday, August 21st. That session will be devoted to 10 indispensable web tools for journalists. So I think it will be very informative and entertaining. If you have any suggestions about future training topics, please email your ideas to us at cebu@cebu.org. Thanks very much for listening. This concludes today's call. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Scott. See you, Tom.
All right. Have a good one. It's been a long time.
Sure.